Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to Clash of the Titles, the podcast that sees two movies with something in common go head-to-head to see which one does it better. And welcome to part two of this week's Mysticism Melee. So, on Monday's episode, we went through John Carpenter's action-adventure comedy kung fu ghost story monster movie that is Big Trouble in Little China. And now, we meet the challenger. It's the film John Carpenter turned down to direct that movie. As the tagline proclaimed, Eddie Murphy is the chosen one. As the song over the opening montage informs us, he's the best man in the world. But is his film the best of the two? Will it be chosen as the champion this week from 1986? We're talking about The Golden Child. At the end of this episode, we will have a winner, but which film will it be? Let's find out. It's Clash of the Titles.
Release the Kraken.
Hello, Clash Potters, and hello, my dear, sweet brother Numsy. I'm Alex Zane.
I'm Vicky Crompton.
I'm Chris Tilly.
So don't forget, you can follow us on Twitter. Getting out there at the start, we are at ClashPod. All sorts of extras about each movie we cover are on our Twitter account, largely run by Chris Tilly, a.k.a. Chris Thrilly. And it really is, as far as Twitter goes, a thrill ride on there. So get on board. Now, as I said, it's part two of this week's Mysticism Melee. These were my choices. Quick reminder of the connection. Everyman and their Eastern Encounters. Subtitle, that's not a man, that's a demon. Because David Lopan and Sardo Numspart are actually demons. Also, John Carpenter famously turned down The Golden Child to direct Big Trouble in Little China. That's enough connections right now. So, on Monday, you'll have heard Christopher takes on a journey through Big Trouble in Little China. It's now the turn of Victoria to tell us of her golden child. Victoria, take us on a journey.
Frank Welker stars as the voice of a demon who wants to kill a golden child, a child who will save humanity through compassion and cuteness. But getting in Frank Welker's way is Eddie Murphy as the world's most blasé social worker or possibly private detective, I'm still not sure, set on a quest by Key, the daughter of a monk, to find the child, taking in dragon rape ladies, actually, the mountains of Tibet and ancient daggers. She is aloof and immune to Eddie Murphy's many charms. She won't even go upstairs with him for a drink the first time they've met the cold fish. But then she saves his life during a fight and her shirt gets all wet and the spark between them jumps into life. After ripping off Indiana Jones, winning a knife using a glass of water, defeating the demon and rescuing the child, Key is resurrected from the dead and her and Eddie Murphy stick a baseball cap on a sacred prophet and this all-American family walk off into the sunset.
I think you've largely made all the points I was going to make. It's a very good intro.
Nobody be alarmed! I'm Adam Chandler, general American stolen artifacts founders of America.
He's irresponsible.
A bed? Is that a bed?
He is a careless, thoughtless, undisciplined fool.
I should be punished. I should be purged. I should be flogged.
You are the chosen one. You will find a child.
Well, I do my best.
I'm so afraid of the dark, too.
I really don't like your attitude.
You know, this is a nice jacket. It's a Morris Day feel, and it looks good on you. And the boots, smoking.
He's got a firm grip on reality. Where he's going, he'll need it.
How'd you do that? What was that with the flip?
You must carry this glass of water without spilling a drop.
Who are you, Monty Hall now?
This is a piece of cake!
Eddie Murphy is the chosen one.
Well, how many people have survived this test?
None! The golden child.
None!
So I've got a really... I'm very connected to this film. So I'll ask you first, how many times have you seen it or where you saw it? And then I'll tell you my truth.
You were very excited last week when this was announced. I've never seen you beside yourself.
The golden child!
I know, it's been such a journey because I now know I'm the only person that feels like that.
I mean, for me, it was a film that was rented a lot on video when we were kids, so it was watched a lot.
Yeah.
That's as far as it goes. I quite enjoyed it as a kid.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't react, obviously, as much as you, because I knew I was picking it and it was news to you, but I was very impressed with your reaction because as a kid, I remember watching this and I remember absolutely loving it. I remember the bit where Charles Dance becomes the big demon thing at the end was a proper what the fuck moment, like an M. Night Shyamalan like twist. I was like, he's a demon? I was like, what? So that really impressed me. But watching it again now, I do remember as a kid thinking it was a lot more epic than what I watched at the weekend, and a lot more coherent. And I remember thinking it was a really impressive action adventure, which I don't think you could categorise it as now.
I found it very disturbing. That's something that I definitely felt as a kid watching this. I was probably watched this a couple of years younger than when I saw Big Trouble. I was probably about 9 or 10 when I watched this.
It's disturbing, like scary or...
Yeah.
Okay.
Scary and also, disturbing in what was going on with...
Yes, two words. Blood porridge.
Blood porridge.
Blood porridge.
I mean, it genuinely messed me up as a kid and I kind of dreaded that scene coming because
I watched
it a lot and it was like...
It's weird, isn't it?
What? It's great.
I think it's because the blood is hidden within the porridge.
Oh, yeah.
So I think it makes you think, I could have had a mouthful of that. I love a bit of porridge. And then, oh, wait, blood in my mouth.
Yeah.
Yeah, also, it's a little girl. It's a young girl.
A dead young girl. Mm.
It's really upsetting for a 10-year-old watching Eddie Murphy movie to be confronted with that.
Well, I think we're going to get onto it, but this is the problem. The problem is that it's an Eddie Murphy that is a bastardised sort of version of a really quite hard-boiled Raymond Chandler-esque detective story that they sort of went, oh, Eddie Murphy will make child death funny, don't worry.
But it's an Eddie Murphy, not in an R-rated, 18-rated comedy. It's PG Eddie Murphy. So it's all these things that are a little bit...
Which is amazing that you can have chunky asses and butt pie as an opening gag in a PG-rated movie. The cover of that porn magazine that gentleman is reading at the newsstand is pretty graphic.
But that's also a mystery to me as well. So I've seen this film easily 20 times. So my granddad, I loved my granddad, and he was a very, he was an early adopter of everything. So he had, a Commodore 128 and then a Commodore 64, and he had, one of the first printers. And there's always a person in your family like that. And if he'd have been alive now, he would have been bedazzled by everything. But he had Home Alone on VHS, and he owned that. So that was big news. And he had The Golden Child. And so me and my sister were just sat upstairs in the computer room watching The Golden Child endlessly. And I can't believe we were allowed to be alone and watching it now. Because there's a mention of rape super early, the blood porridge itself, which I loved, and I can only think that it was given to me to watch because I loved Ghostbusters so much, and there are similar...
Yeah.
If you were my granddad, you'd be like, well, she likes ghosts, and she likes people being funny, and he probably didn't watch it to understand that it's not funny, and then I was allowed to watch it multiple times.
I also, I'm a man who, over the years, has amassed a ridiculously large DVD collection, and I sometimes think, I don't need all these movies. And what I love is the clarity at which your granddad approached owning VHSs. I've got Home Alone and I've got The Golden Child. And you know what? I'm done. That is my collection right there.
Honestly, that's what he never got anything else.
In the halls of residence I lived in my first year at uni, we had a guy called Phil the third year, and he was the only person with a video in the building. And he only had two videos, and it was Die Hard and Lee Evans Live. And every night we'd come home, he didn't really go out much. Every night we'd come home, he'd be drinking beer in his room watching Die Hard and Lee Evans Live. Again?
Yeah. So imagine my surprise. I thought everybody loved this film. I thought it was hilarious. I thought it was exciting. And doing some research, people just don't feel like that. But obviously we'll get there.
It's an interesting one, isn't it? I saw that as well. It's like this... I read a lot of people talking about what a forgotten movie it was. They listed it as one of these blockbusters that made a shit ton of money at the box office when it was released and then has somehow been forgotten. But I've never forgotten it.
No, me neither. Yeah. I guess if you were of that generation, it was a big film. But I guess the generations that come since have not made this, rediscovered this.
Yeah.
No.
So, it went on a bit of a journey in terms of the story and the humour and the star. It was a spec screenplay by a man called Dennis Feldman, but it was intended for Mel Gibson with George Miller to direct. But Eddie Murphy took it, and the story goes, and I don't know if this is true, but he reached out to George Miller to be like, it's me now, but do you still want to do it? But made him wait for hours and hours and hours. So George Miller was like, fuck you, dude. I'm not going to do that. And then John Carpenter was offered it and said no. And then you get Michael Ritchie instead. But the writer didn't feel, ultimately, that Michael Ritchie did a brilliant job. And it had changed so much, apparently, at the last minute to put more of a shot of like Eddie Murphy-style humour in there. So it moves from this Raymond Chandler-style film with supernatural stuff going on. I think it was called The Rose of Tibet. I mean, that doesn't matter. But it wasn't what he wanted.
It's just so you know, I did read the original script because
really?
You can get it online, yeah. And it's the non Eddie Murphy version of this script, and it's fascinating. Mm. It actually opens. So Dennis Feldman, I did that little bit of research. He wrote Species, Species 2, and a movie that I am absolutely going to do on Clash Pod in the future because I think it's brilliant, even though it's fucking awful, which is the Jamie Lee Curtis, Donald Sutherland horror sci-fi Virus, which if anyone's seen it will know what a great film that is for us to talk about. But nevertheless, the script actually, at the start of his script, it has a quote from Raymond Chandler. And then it goes on. And the best way of me describing this to you is, you know the scene at the newsstand where he does the chunky ass's butt pie?
He likes saying that, doesn't he? That's about the fifth time he's done it.
Because it's such a... To me, watching it as an adult, this is not great Murphy improvisation because it doesn't even make much sense.
No,
and he doesn't seem sold on it. He goes, butt pie, that's a sequel to the bestseller Butt Cake, where it's just a lot of butt with cake on it. And you're like,
what?
Yeah.
Okay.
What?
So, family film.
So the hangover, there's an actual hangover. So in the original script...
Is that the script there?
Yeah, yeah.
Can I have a look in a minute?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, don't just sit there reading. Dead air.
Okay. It sounds like Chris doesn't want you to have it till after the show. you can have it if you're good. There's a hangover. So in the original script... Chandler goes into a magazine shop and he holds up the Cheryl Moseley one sheet that the posters he's putting up to the guy and goes, mind if I put this up? And this guy goes, suit yourself. And he looks behind the door and goes, what happened to the ones I put here last week? And the guy goes, who the hell knows? I told you last time, we've got no underage stuff here. And anyway, he puts it on the door, goes out, and then the guy gets up and rips it down. And then the character Chandler smashes the door into him, walks in, and the guy's like groaning and he smashes the door into him again. And then he sees three people run out, another child who he's been looking for, and a chase ensues. And that is the original script that involved any reference to pornography or a magazine store. And it's just completely different to what we get in the Eddie Murphy version, to the point where if I was Dennis Feldman, and if you read the script, it's great. You can see why John Carpenter read this script and went, this is a very fine script, because he didn't see how much it was going to be torn apart to create this star vehicle for Murphy.
Yeah, and I have a quote from Dennis Feldman saying, I think that wasn't what Eddie should have done, and it's not what the director should have done, and he didn't even do it that well either. It was a nightmare. So he obviously didn't love it. And I think it's fairly well known that the score was changed at the last minute. So originally you had a John Barry score, which would have been apparently very dignified, very grand. And it was switched at the last minute for a much more, let's say, contemporary poppy score, which is quite distracting, but very of its time. And I think me watching it as a child, that just made perfect sense that it would be that score because it's daft. But
yeah,
it's...
because the bit where they're into bed at the start and the synth start, I'm like, brilliant.
Yeah, me too.
Welcome to Tibet. Welcome to Tibet, in brackets, present day.
Nothing says Tibet like electro.
So, yeah, that's all I've got on the background, unless there's anything major.
I read a book, which I talked about the other day, actually, on the Kadishak episode, Wild and Crazy Guys by Nick Desemlian, which is really good about all the SNL performers and their film careers. And he said that until this script caught his eye, Murphy was going to play an alien-obsessed professor of astrophysics at Berkeley in Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home.
That's right, yeah.
I can't see that working. That's even less... That makes less sense than this. And he also claims that once he said that Murphy thought that Miller was weird. He didn't want to work with George Miller.
Okay.
But he wanted Spielberg or Clint Eastwood, and Scorsese was briefly attached as well.
Well, there was that thing, wasn't there? I think by this point, after Beverly Hills Cop, Eddie Murphy was too famous to play the black guy in other movies. And so it had to be star vehicles for him, which is why I'm sure if the Voyage Home thing was true, but it's also the Ghostbusters story as well, all of that, you know, he was, you know, a big star, one of the biggest stars, if not the biggest comic on the planet at this point.
Yeah, he was Paramount's cash cow, basically, and he wouldn't make a decision on what he wanted to do next. He was just happy to have a good time. And so that's why they bought this for $330,000, this script, because it was the only one he actually showed an interest in. But that's all I got.
I will say one other thing, just because you brought it up already, and this is the last time I'm going to reference the script, because we can talk about it afterwards. We can talk about it afterwards when Chris isn't going to get angry. So, you know, you were like, I'm not sure what Eddie Murphy's job in this. Mm. In the original script, the bit where he visits the house with the blood porridge and meets the detective, which, again, I can see why you're confused because it doesn't explain what the fuck he's doing there. It's like, well, how are you just...
You're wandering around a crime scene.
And the police are like, come on into this crime scene. Hey, look, there's some blood porridge. What do you make of that? The police detective actually says to him, so you only take kid cases, huh? Which is actually still in the movie.
Yeah.
And he goes, yeah. And then the detective goes, why don't you go back to the Department of Social Welfare and take home a regular paycheck? And Chandler goes, I like being self-employed. Oh. And then the detective goes, is that what you call it? And he goes, yeah. And that's how, so we actually understand what his job is, as opposed to wondering who this man is, putting up posters of children.
The closest we get to it is they say he's a finder of lost children.
Yeah, but that just sounds like a child catcher. And it's not helped by him doing this. Doesn't he do that creepy thing? And he's like, I just really like working with kids. And it's like, doesn't... okay.
What's your very favourite thing that you've ever seen Eddie Murphy in? Just out of interest, but while we go here.
I saw, what is it called? My Name is Dolomite, or Dolomite is My Name, recently.
Yeah.
I thought that was brilliant.
It's really good. Trading Places.
Okay. Mine is the opening sketch of Saturday Night Live, Series 7, Episode 7. He does a skit with Tim Curry. That's the second obligatory Tim Curry reference of the week. There's two there. Take your pick. That's one an episode. So we're back on track with those. I know Chris is a fan. I know Chris is a fan of those moments. So it's not because they don't really interrupt the flow of the conversation. They just sort of, they naturally just fit in.
It's not a conversational sort of blind, dead alley kind of thing.
No.
We all find it really difficult to get back on what we're supposed to be doing.
Yeah.
I like it. I don't know what I'm bitching about. I do like it.
Yeah, well, don't bitch about it because, you know, there'll be a conversation afterwards. you want to read the script, Victoria? Well, I'll trade you
can't
for
now.
No, your Tim Curry reference.
You'll get a sternly worded message on WhatsApp.
Okay, so the film. Let's just do a tiny bit of setup, just in case someone hasn't seen this amazing, amazing film. We have a golden child in Tibet who is kidnapped and quite accepting of his kidnap, even though, tilly trivia, that's a girl, not a boy, playing the golden child. But let's just get that cleared off. And then, thank God for Charles Dance.
Now works for the Hollywood Reporter.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
Yeah.
See the tilly? We just did a bit of like a trivia back and forth.
In events.
It's actually true.
It's true. Yeah.
Eddie Murphy and her met for the first time
last year at Toronto Film Festival. When I was there.
The first time in
what's going
30,
on?
For the first time in 33 years they met last year.
Oh, there's really? A lovely picture of them together, which I'll post on the Twitter. I will post on the Twitter.
Anyway.
In events!
was much cooler than that.
It's like you gave me such a weird look while you were doing it. Just stare through me in events. So this child will save humanity if he will use he dies, compassion dies, whatever that means. So, but the important thing is we get to meet Charles Dance as, what's his name again?
Sardo Numspa.
I don't know. Sardo Numspa being super evil, and that's good. But that is all to take us to Eddie Murphy, who, as you've mentioned, he's the best fucking man in the world.
He's the best man in the world.
And he finds missing children. He doesn't seem, well, I'm being rude. Is he that good at it? He does find the missing child, Cheryl Moseley, but she's dead. So he's fucked up somewhere along the line.
You have to read the contract. Did I say I'd find her alive?
That's true.
I just said I'd find it. I still expect paying for whatever job it is I do.
Yeah. And we also meet Ki Nang, who is a Tibetan monk's daughter by way of Kensington and Chelsea.
Yeah. English Rose Ki Nang.
Yeah. She's in LA for some reason. And that's fine. So she's going to recruit Eddie Murphy to the quest of find the golden child. And she goes, the first scene, which is, I mean, it is a little bit disappointing. So he's on the basketball court shouting at some kids, a little bit of funniness there. Like, I love kids. Hey, kids, I hate you or whatever. And we're waiting for some fizz and some like Eddie Murphy magic. And there's a very done to death joke about the scroll that she's got being like a big reefer. Mm-hmm. And it just doesn't ever elevate itself from that position.
So this is one of those moments you were talking about at the start, which was probably added later. Because by all accounts, the first version of this they shot with Eddie Murphy wasn't a huge deviation from the Mel Gibson version. It was going to be a very different kind of Eddie Murphy we saw on screen. And then they got cold feet, Paramount, and went, no, Eddie Murphy it! And so we get sort of half-assed improv like that. I mean, look, I love Eddie Murphy. Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting to see someone do that with the script and sort of add something different. But it just doesn't help this movie particularly.
It feels like they printed his first try of each scene.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And rather than let's develop this, but his ego was wild at this time. And so maybe that's what was happening on set. He was just dictating, I nailed it there. On to the next one.
I want to go pie later. But as you've done already, Alex, all he does is say ass constantly. I'm going to beat your ass. I'm going to beat your ass. Whatever. Like that's his like added little button to a joke.
I agree though, because I did write down making my notes watching it. This is not funny as I remember. But as it went on, 40 minutes later, I was laughing and I deleted it. Because it's like, oh, it is funny. It just it takes a while. A bit like Big Drum, Little Child, maybe. It takes a while to hit its stride.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. And I think, unfortunately, as well, I think some of the funny parts are when he gets to at least dip into his bottomless pit of rude words and do
ass jokes.
Well, I like the bit where he's like trying to go through customs in Tibet and he's pretends he's from the American Stolen Artifacts Federation. He goes, Freddy, that piece of shit back there. And I'm like, anyone using the term piece of shit gets a pass from me.
Really?
Yeah, I love it. My dog's a piece of shit.
Poor Simon.
Oh, Simon. So, little plot point. Blood porridge. Blood porridge is important because it connects the missing girl, Cheryl, now dead, to the golden child, which is supposed to help Eddie Murphy become more recruited to this quest. We end up with a biker gang. Again, seen this film 20 million times. Can't remember how we end up with a biker gang. But it's meant to be the opportunity for a little bit of fizz between Ki and Eddie Murphy. He's like, stay in the car, woman, whatever. And she's like, okay, definitely. Or doesn't even speak. And then she doesn't stay in the car. And it turns out she's a fucking badass. And she saves him.
It's very empowering, that moment.
Very empowering.
Sure, yeah.
Very empowering.
Do you mean the bit where her shirt gets wet?
Her shirt gets very wet.
Very, it's very
really
wet.
She ain't wearing a bra.
She's not, is she?
See-through white top.
And she's not a flat-chested lady.
No.
So
it's just so astonishing because it starts off by going, she's going to save his ass because she knows kung fu, and here we go. Oh my god, it's wet.
It's
a lot of wetness.
It's so ridiculous, and she just has to do that. It's just like, oh, okay.
It's a bit depressing.
It is a little bit depressing. And then there's later, she saves him again in the restaurant, and she does. So they end up in a restaurant again. I can't fucking remember why now. to find someone. And she does this cool flip across the room to like put to get him out of the way of danger. Mm. But all that happens is she flips, and then she does something. It's like the flip is supposed to be you're avoiding like a bullet or a dagger or whatever, but she should have just run.
What would be good is if that flip came in later in the film with different results.
Agreed.
Yeah. One of the times she's flipping, she's not wearing trousers as well.
That's true, yeah.
Again, it's like, what are they doing?
It's only parallel. It's only beaten, I'm jumping ahead, but I'll mention it twice, by the moment where he won't fuck her, so she cries. I just thought it was amazing. He's like, no, I'm going to sleep on the sofa. She's like, whoa. Oh, dear.
Did you do any reading around? I didn't really know Charlotte Lewis, so I started reading around her. There's interesting stories about her relationship with Roman Polanski.
That, oh, really?
Yes. I think she accused him of something horrible he did to her.
But, they made Pirates a year before this.
Right.
And, yeah, I mean, she was 17 and he was...
He was not.
He was not.
He was Roman Polanski.
Classic Roman.
I don't know. It's a classic moment, Chris. I honestly.
I didn't know why you brought it up. I
don't either.
This film.
But as I was trying to get out of it, I didn't expect you to do a classic Roman. So I think to be fair, we're both at fault. Let's move on.
Let's talk about a Pepsi can dancing to Putting on the Ritz. Minor gripe. The Golden Child sort of enchants the can to dance to Putting on the Ritz. There should be no show tunes in a monastery, but nonetheless, it's one of the best moments of the film, so fine.
Yeah, it reminds me of a film that I wasn't here for the conversation, but Young Sherlock Holmes. Where we had those like remarkable special effects that were completely jaw-dropping at the time. And I think we've got used to seeing cool effects in movies now. They all meld into one, but it was so unusual getting this stuff in these weird fantasy family films.
I think that dancing Pepsi can has more of a charm than half the special effects we see these days as well. Yep. The way it folds itself into a human form. After Young Frankenstein, it is my favourite Putting on the Ritz version of film.
And then there's this sort of wedged in plot device, which is now Charles Dance, because the child won't eat the blood porridge, which is understandable.
I think you should call him by his character name.
I can't. Sidon Numspar.
Yes, it's so nice to say.
Yeah, it is.
By the way, sorry, does he? I don't think he looks like a Sado Numspar.
It's an interesting choice for it. Is it? I assumed it was based in reality, real myth kind of thing. Is it not? Well, who knows?
No, I don't know.
We didn't have that level of research, I suppose. Because it's so easy to make it sound.
It's your movie, so.
Yeah.
It's not that we didn't do that level of research.
He's like a pale ginger white guy. He doesn't look like a Sado Numspar.
No, he looks like like a Lionel. But he's not really that man, is he?
He's a dragon.
Yeah. Well, it's not a dragon.
Demon thing.
Yeah.
I'm
not saying it.
Plot device.
He's not a D-man.
It's growing on you. I can tell. It's growing on you.
You can have one of the T-shirts. So now we can only use the Ajanti dagger to kill the Golden Child and nothing else. Then we get one of I'd completely forgotten this bit, which is the sort of the very extended dream sequence, which is where Sado Numspar is going to convince Eddie Murphy how like spooky serious this whole shit is by burning his arm really horrifically. And he sort of hardly feels it, but he's like, you're in a dream, but this will show you that this I can manipulate dreams or something.
Does he burn his arm? I thought he cut his arm with the dagger. I think he drags the dagger down it, cutting a massive wound into his arm.
Yeah.
I think he draws the shape of the dagger in his arm with his nail.
With burn.
Yeah, with burn. With burning nail.
With a burning dagger. With a burning nail dagger. Yeah, I find that dream sequence kind of weird.
Because
the sitcom setting, the fact that it's a TV show with the audience and the applause, it's very 80s. It's really weird, but it reminds me of Natural Born Killers.
So I have a theory here that Eddie Murphy at this time was quite critical of his audience and the fact that he would... Steve Martin went through the same thing. Steve Martin stopped doing stand-up comedy because he would walk out on stage and he wouldn't do anything, people would laugh, and he could drop a pen and pick it up and people would laugh, and it stopped being stand-up for him because it was just built in. And the fact that you've got this audience of very specifically old white people laughing at everything Eddie Murphy says, even when it isn't funny. I wondered if he added that as a comment on his frustration with where his career was with that what his audience suddenly became white people laughing at everything he said, and that's not where he came from.
Mm. That's interesting. I hadn't thought of that. But yeah, it's a very strange moment anyway. Mm.
Yeah. But also, let's not forget, he gets to imagine Key tied to a sideboard with toilet roll. Is that right?
Wearing PVC. Yeah, no, it's toilet paper.
Which is strange, because, I mean, toilet paper, you cannot tie someone up with toilet paper.
You certainly can't.
Believe me.
Not for want of trying. Mm. But just don't be cheap. You know, just buy some rope. Not a big deal. It's your dream. Do you know what I mean? You can do anything you want. Why have you used toilet roll?
Yeah. And it's weird, you know, because I imagine, you know, there's a lot of toilet roll being used at that to tie her up. And
well, maybe it's to be cool and to be like, she could get free if she wanted to because it's just loo roll.
Right.
So all she'd have to do is free herself. Mm-hmm. So she's not actually a sex slave.
Do you know what I think? I think what bothered me about it is the proximity of toilet roll to PVC underwear, which to me, people wear, it's rubber pants. It's because...
Yeah,
you know, if you're not very good with the old toilet situation, you know.
change the subject. Alex, you can tell me if this is in the script, because we, also just before the dream sequence, we had a scene where a rat turns into Sada Numspar, and then Sada Numspar turns back into the rat. And Dennis Feldman said he was heartbroken. I was made to edit out 20 pages of the script. There was a very sinister supernatural character with a rat's head and a human body who smoked. He went as soon as Eddie was signed onto it. In the minds of the producers, it had to be a comedy. I thought it would have been a much better idea to have him play it straight as an action hero. Mm. But yeah, is that? Do you remember that?
I thought you were going to say, was that you?
A human with a rat's body who smokes. That sounds pretty cool.
It does sound really cool. Weirdly, I do have written down around that point in the script, although it's I don't know, I can't confirm whether it's in the original script or not. I didn't see that bit. And it's not on the two pages I brought with me, which I will show to you later.
After.
There's a funny bit of improv where Eddie Murphy says to her when the guy's dead, Tommy Tong, I believe it is.
Yeah,
is
yeah,
dead.
Tommy Tong's restaurant. Yeah, yeah.
Tommy Tong's dead. Sada Numspar kills him. And then Eddie Murphy finds the body and says, maybe the guy knew I was coming, got scared and killed himself. Which is a great bit of improv. Mm.
Yeah.
It's good.
The only other thing about the dream sequence, which is this is very nitpicky, and again, I just could not have been paying attention. But Charles Dance keeps saying to Eddie Murphy, I'm not going to repeat my offer. You do what I ask you to do, which is, and then doesn't say it. I'm going to tell you one more. He's like, I'm making you an offer. It doesn't actually say what it is.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Am I right?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah. And that's why I wrote down earlier, it's a bit shoddy. This has been put together quite shoddily because he never does say the offer. And you're like, what offer? What are you talking about?
What are you talking about? And that just annoys me because you could even fix that in an edit. Just stop saying, I won't tell you again or whatever. But the offer is get the knife and I'll swap you for the child. Something.
Yeah, he wants the knife to kill the child, but he wants to exchange the child for the knife. That's the two things
very, very
happening.
Confusing. It sounds it's a very confusing deal.
Let's talk more about this confusion.
The child's
after
in
a small break.
Oh yeah,
thank
getting
you.
Getting emotional there.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedy-ad-free. That's amazon.com/comedy-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Right, so let's go to Tibet, because we might as well. So, we're off to Tibet, which is good, because you have been waiting for Eddie Murphy to get to Tibet. Lots of jokes about being freezing. No, the same joke about being freezing for ages. But it takes us to a scene I definitely remember from being little, and I still thought it was very funny, even though it's just one line, which is the I want the knife scene, where he wiggles, that he spins the prayer wheel and just says, I want the knife.
I want the knife.
It's funny. It's really disrespectful, but it's really funny.
It's great.
Yep.
And also we get that nice scene with Victor Wong where he goes, monkey breath, eater of turtle spine, which is great. Yeah. You're breaking my hat, asswipe.
Yeah. More ass jokes, but still very funny. Mm-hmm. We've got our Indiana Jones ripoff. I suppose it's a bit unfair to label everything that's like a quest in a spooky looking mystical place an Indiana Jones ripoff, but it wouldn't feel as painful if it was good. But the perspective trick, the only, you know, only the sort of the right sort of man can do this. What annoyed me is he has to go and get the knife and he's got a glass of water, yes? Mm-hmm. And again, for the last time, I've seen this film a million times. And this scene didn't end the way that I remember it ending, which would be what, do you think? So he's got the glass of water, he makes it across the plinths.
Yeah, he's supposed to chuck it on the fire.
Yeah.
Yeah, he doesn't.
He drinks it. I know. And then he doesn't even drink it or spit it on the fire. Yeah. He just drinks it.
He just drinks it and then the fire goes out. I mean, there's so much to unpack in that. So the fire is sentient and is aware that he's now drunk the water and then will go out.
Yeah. If he was on the Comedy Central show Taskmaster, he would have failed that task.
I've never seen...
Greg Davis would not have given him the points. I've been watching a lot of it the last week. It's very good.
Yeah. I would say Taskmaster. So maybe a different show. Yeah, that just annoyed me because why else is it in fire? And I swear to God it didn't end like that, but it does. So there we are. And then a scene which I believe a lot of people find very funny, if you look at YouTube, which is the sneaking the knife through customs scene.
It's funny.
Yeah, it's okay.
Oh, I liked it. I liked it.
Yeah, but could you not just check it on as luggage?
Do you know what? I think no is the short answer to that. But also I think Eddie Murphy's improv works best when he's got an audience, like in a movie. Like I think like when he's got spectators and he's sort of almost like managing a crowd and it's quite dynamic because he's got all these extras who don't really know what he's going to do and he can play with them and interact with them. Like when he goes down the line, shaking their hands and saying thank you to them. And both there and in the airport when he lands and Sado Numspar is waiting for him and he's got an audience and he can sort of play off a lot of things. And then it feels like he's really sparking because he's got a lot of tools at his disposal.
Equally, he's Axel Foley at that point, isn't he? When he's busting Sado Numspar's balls, he's Axel Foley. And it is very funny, but it's something you've seen before. It's literally a different character.
Yeah. I mean, I was going to save this quote till later, but I'm going to do it now because it sort of explains a lot about this film and everything that we're talking about. And it's from Charles Dance. He says, initially, The Golden Child was a very interesting script with a lot of resonances, but Paramount basically chickened out. When they first screened it, it was a very different sort of film for Eddie Murphy. Paramount took too much notice of the preview audience's unease about the unfamiliarity of Eddie's character. They had gotten to know him so well through Beverly Hills Cop that they wanted the character to be so much more like that. So the studio went back and reshot a lot of footage of Eddie doing Eddie Murphyisms and put them into the picture. Then they took out the really sumptuous, weird and beautiful score and placed it with something more funky. So basically what you got was Beverly Hills Cop in Tibet.
But not as good.
Right.
That's a pitch. I mean, that's it, isn't it?
It is.
And I think there's an issue as well with his character because I think Sado Numspar's really frightening in the same way that Lo Pan's frightening in Big Trouble in Little China. But Lo Pan surrounds himself with the Three Storms, who are these intimidating, cool characters. Whereas with Sado Numspar,
I call it the Otis issue, where in Superman, Lex Luthor's the greatest criminal mind of our time, and his assistant is Otis, who's an idiot who keeps fucking up. Like, if you're the greatest criminal mind, why would you have that person doing your bidding? And this guy, Sido Numsba's got these idiots doing his bidding who keep messing up with Goldie.
It's a human resources issue, basically. You can be an evil D-man, but you can be shit at recruitment, basically. That's all it is.
Again, read the script. It's online. Read the original script. And those men are painted as fucking terrifying.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
And it's the D'Souza quote again that I keep saying, where he says, as soon as you're villain, the villain doesn't become ridiculous, but as soon as his henchmen are, the threat's gone.
But it's got to be one way or the other. I think that's the problem. I think Charles Dance is threatening in it, but I also think it's his face when Eddie Murphy is going, "Brother Numsy," and then kisses Charles Dance on the cheek. His face is priceless. It's like, it's gold. It's like this beautiful thing. And I think at that point, I guess it would be more funny to have a villain who at least... Well, no, I'm going back on myself, because you still need a villain who's threatening. So I'm correcting myself. That's wrong. What I'm saying is wrong. It's rare that you'll hear that. Enjoy it. Bask in that.
Turn that into a clip for Twitter. So we're sort of into the final, the momentum of the final act, which is now there's another handy plot device, which is the golden child can only be killed at night for some reason.
Yeah, the arbitrary nonsense. Yeah. And appears to have the powers of the Force from Star Wars as well.
Yeah, but didn't prevent themselves from being kidnapped in the first place. So Charles Dance says it just puts her in a cage with no resistance, which would be fine, I think, which again, I thought I remembered this from childhood, but definitely not, because I thought it was like the fulfillment of some sort of prophecy. I know that Eddie Murphy is the chosen one, and so he has to fulfill his end of the scroll bargain. So that's why I thought the golden child went quietly into the cage, because it's like, this has to happen in order that something happens. But it isn't like that. Like, the golden child could have rescued herself earlier on, and it would have been fine. There isn't anything else that happens as a result of this whole adventure.
This whole bit is... This whole climax is nonsense. There's the bit where Eddie Murphy and the golden child are in a car, and aside from the hilarious line where he goes, "Did somebody give you a Valium or what?" Because the child isn't saying anything. But they're driving along, and the demon is flying around after them, and they crash the car. And then they run out of the car because they've crashed it and they can't drive the car anymore because it's crashed into something. And they run out and they run into that tower and then they have a fight with the demon and then they run back out and get back in the car that they crashed and drive off again. And it's like, you're not even trying to disguise the fact someone went, "We need a tower-based action sequence here with the demon."
Yeah, I got confused. I thought they'd driven to the tower to trap the demon. But you're saying that they know they just crashed the car.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, that doesn't make any sense.
No. We've forgotten, and we have to mention it because we foreshadowed that earlier little script trick for you there, that Key sacrifices herself for her love of Eddie Murphy. She does her flip, or she should have just run or whatever, and she gets a crossbow through the back, even though when she's laid out dead later, it doesn't appear to have penetrated her shirt in any way, so she's got bloodless.
But the shirt is dry at this point.
It's bone dry, thank God. And then she says, which really drives me mental, like, in when they're first getting to know each other, now, well, then, but especially with modern eyes, he is coming onto her too strong. He's like, "Come upstairs for a drink, bitch." Not really. She fucking won.
Eddie, we are loving the improv. We're gonna pull you back a little there. Just a little. Pull you back a little. That's too much.
Yeah, but don't stop being you. So she won't come upstairs for a drink.
Whore good? Whore? No, no.
What about prick tease?
dirty sloot. Dirty sloot. No, why don't you just say it's fine. Say it's fine.
Just say it's fine. I won't ask again. Oh, no, that's the thing. Was it? Isn't there a line
they make a
like,
point. She says he asked twice and said no twice.
Yeah. He says, they always say, always ask a woman twice or something. Yeah, and he's like, they definitely don't.
And doesn't she lock the door and he smashes the window to try and get to her?
So she won't go upstairs with him. And she, because she doesn't want to, and that's the end of that conversation. But then she has to apologise for it. And it's not enough to apologise for that with her actual life. She has to say to him, ridiculously, I didn't go upstairs with you because I loved you, having met you for 30 minutes.
Well, no, because she doesn't sleep with him that time, but then she sleeps with him a bit later in the film.
Oh, yeah.
Because...
to make him go to Tibet, classic.
No, but then she says she didn't sleep with him.
Yeah, she's lying. She's definitely for lying. Yeah, because he's like, I won't go to Tibet. She's like, all right, fine.
Because
then,
what's frustrating about that is that Eddie Murphy is told by the old man that he has to remain pure and love someone who loves you. And so when they're on the trip, that means he's not allowed to sleep with her.
Yes.
And that's why this weird conversation's happening. But that would be so much better if he hadn't already slept with her.
Mm. Yeah.
He slept with her two nights ago.
Well,
so
that's why she's crying. She's like, what the fuck is this double standard bullshit? Like, it was fine before, it's not fine now. Yeah. No way.
We should also point out that Victor Wong, it does play her, is it her dad or her granddad in this?
Her dad.
Her dad, yeah. So,
Which is a nice little twist.
Was it?
It's not a twist. It's
it
just
is. He's set up as a simpleton at the start when he first shows up on screen.
Yeah.
Who's pretending to have no legs, like Eddie Murphy does in Trading Places. They use the exact same joke, and then it turns out he's actually the key to this whole thing. The advice, he knows everything, and he's maybe been behind it all.
But he doesn't know his daughter's going to get killed by a crossbow. Because otherwise he'd say, just watch out when there's a crossbow.
I think he does. I think it's all part of what's going to happen.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah, no, that does make sense. Because then Eddie Murphy really has to save the golden child.
Puts her on the part. Yeah, has to trust someone he's just met.
Well, maybe he read Dennis Feldman's original script.
Yeah, oh, could be. So he has to save the golden child, which is done fairly straightforwardly, apart from a car that crashes and then is fine. And Key is led out in a... Now, it's explained that as long as sunlight touches her, the golden child can resurrect her.
Yeah.
Quick question. Would you put her in a basement? You wouldn't, would you?
No.
You put her outside.
In a garden.
In a garden.
Greenhouse.
With no trees, no nothing. Just to get full sunlight for what is, I believe is called a day. Rather than...
You buy a sun lamp. You get one of those sun lamps and just sort of see, well, you didn't specify actual sunlight.
But that's not what happens. What he does is he puts her in a basement where it only gets the sun sort of, maybe the first part of the morning. So by the time the golden child gets to her, it's just on her beautiful foot. But that's enough for the golden child to resurrect her. Everything's fine. That's kind of it. Put a cap on the kid.
I wrote that direct. So America starts destroying this young kid's innocence by clothes and a high five.
As I understood it, though, the kid is going back to Tibet.
Yeah.
Tibet. They've not set up as a new family unit.
Eddie Murphy asked him if he's got Star Search in Tibet. I believe that's his last joke in the film, which is not a banger.
Going out on a high there. But that's it. But then having said all that and having, maybe I've come across very negative, it's just that trick of childhood where it's impossible to hate something you loved so deeply, even though it's obviously flawed.
I do remember the demon being better, the D-man. I was less impressed this time. This is the first time I've sort of gone, God, that's shoddy. That's really quite
but
shoddy.
But aren't you just judging it with modern eyes? Incredible then. It was incredible. They must have spent so much of this budget on that at the time.
Do you think so? I think compared to films of the time, I think it's a little bit messy. It doesn't look as good as other special effects of a similar ilk. It feels a bit rushed, in my opinion.
Hearing an example, it's very vague.
That's intentionally vague.
Agree to disagree.
Right, fine.
So, have you got any more? We got grown up Golden Child's full CV.
Well, I do. I can tell you which hotel Eddie Murphy and her met at after 33 years. I say it was the St. Regis Hotel.
So. Yeah, I was there. That's why I missed that. That's why I missed that show.
What?
The young show. I was in Toronto when you were
talking
recording.
To the Golden Child.
Nah. I was watching Dolomite though.
All right.
Reading around it, the reviews were bad at the time.
Some
of them were really racist. Like, I didn't write some of them down. There was some really horrible things written, and I found this quote from Murphy in 1987, so a year later. Someone asked him how he felt about the bad reviews and the negative reception. He said, "You had a black man that was not only a realistic sexual presence, but who saved the world from the devil. Not the day, but the world. I think it was a subconscious thing with a lot of white critics. I really feel on some level white critics had a hard time dealing with that. And I think I read that quote and I thought, really? And I started looking around. Yeah, absolutely. They absolutely did. Really? It was so much about his race, people having a problem with his race, which shouldn't play into any of it. But then, so he's saying that the film was good in that quote. 2 years later, different quote, Rolling Stone, my pictures make their money back, no matter how I feel. For instance, The Golden Child, which was a piece of shit, that movie made more than $100 million. So who am I to say what sucks?
It was a huge hit, though.
I know.
Huge hit. Yeah.
Surprising we didn't get more. But maybe a good thing. We got more Beverly Hills Cop instead, and that didn't exactly improve as it went along.
Beverly Hills Cop 2 is better than Beverly Hills Cop.
New.
Yes, it is. New. I prefer Beverly Hills Cop 2.
Okay.
Beverly Hills Cop 3 can fuck off. But
save it for a clash of the titles in the
future. All right, yeah, all right.
Would you like to do the bits?
Yeah. Let's do the bits.
Yep. Chris, what was your best scene?
You're breaking my hat, asswipe.
Doesn't he look good in a tracksuit as well? It's amazing.
When that guy shows up and calls him monkey breath and puke face and scuzz bucket, and then we discover his legs do work and he stole the money. I found that the funniest scene in the film, to be honest, as a kid, and I still think it's the funniest bit. So, yeah going for that.
Best scene for me, and I'm surprised you didn't mention this once, and I'm assuming you're going to bring it up now, because it's the scene that I remember the most as a child from this movie, and that is the 300-year-old half-dragon librarian. And the fact that she is half a dragon.
Yeah.
And you see her silhouette early on, and then you do the big reveal at the end, and she's all there being all stop-motion-y, going, I'm a dragon lady. I love that, because I like the idea, which is also in Big Trouble in Little China, which is this idea of a subterranean world underneath, like a modern city, just like one floor down, there's all these mythical creatures and monsters and magic going on. And I think that's just really, really cool. And so it's the woman who's... Well, mother was raped by a dragon.
Yeah, and don't they do it the third time? So the rule of three, and you reveal on the third.
Yes.
And that's always good. Mm. What does he say to her? You're not normal. You can't stay down here smoking cigarettes and watching tele or something. And that's quite funny.
Yeah.
mine is the Pepsi can thing, which, because it's cute and I like it.
I had trouble thinking of a favourite scene in this one, I'll be honest.
Did you really?
Yeah. I didn't really have... There wasn't a scene that really stood out for
me. He wanted to say... When she gets her shirt wet, but he knew that I would be cross about it. Mm. So
no, I understand.
Yeah. She looks great. MVW, Alex.
Charles Dance. You needed more of him. More of him and Murphy on screen together, because he is the perfect foil for Murphy's improv. That bit at the airport where he does the brother numpsy stuff and kisses him. As I said before, Charles Dance's face is exactly the reaction you want from the villain. Plus, Eddie Murphy's improv works best when you cannot believe the balls on his character, taking on someone who he knows is so evil, killed people, may or may not be a fucking demon, and he's still just making fun of him. And he does the same. Yes, it's like Beverly Hills Cop, but it just really works with his improv. And that moment's great. And I just think Charles Dance is really good in it. And I cannot believe that they didn't use him more. And I remember there being more of him as a kid, because he left such a large imprint in my mind.
And the way you dress today.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Welcome. It's a very nice cravat I'm wearing. In this very hot room.
What about you?
Yeah, PG Eddie Murphy isn't the best Eddie Murphy. So I'm going to say you're breaking my heart, asswipe, and going for Victor Wong as the old man. I think he's really great in this film.
I think the Golden Child, who now works in events for Hollywood Reporter, for a character that doesn't speak, does she, at all?
I think as they're walking off, doesn't he say, can I have a burger? I love America. God bless America or something.
Are you making that up?
Yeah, I'm making that up, yeah.
Okay.
The kid says everything's going to be okay. Or he says everything's going to be okay and the kid says, I know.
Yeah.
That's a good moment.
But beatific, like a very memorable on-screen presence for a child, first and foremost, and also for a child that barely speaks.
My only qualm with the character, and it's how it's written, it's not the performance, is the fact at the start... they have brought a tray of four dead parrots, and he ums and ahs and like, which one shall I bring back to life? And then brings one back to life. And it's like, so you killed, why didn't you just kill one parrot and give the child one parrot? Because you give it a selection and it's not going to bring three of them back to life. So just give it one dead parrot and it'll do its trick. It's like, I didn't understand why you had to kill four parrots and then only one got to be resurrected.
I thought...
I know we feel differently about killing animals, but...
I mean, that's my problem.
Mm.
I thought...
You were like, well, that's one too many parrots brought back to life.
I just don't... I didn't even register. But I thought it was because if it was just one dead parrot and then it could be a fluke, that it was like maybe asleep or...
So we weren't meant to know the child could bring things back to life at that point.
Yeah. Right. And or if one child resurrects one parrot, someone in the back could be like, bullshit, that parrot was asleep. I want to see four dead parrots. You know, like getting heckled.
In fact, I don't want you to do one of the parrots on the plate. I'll bring you a new dead parrot that I've
yeah.
killed.
Yeah, it's like the beer bottle in Big Trouble. It's like, no, not that bottle,
yep.
my bottle.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. All right, I get that.
And if you could change one thing, Alex?
I would have liked to have seen the original version of this. I haven't read the script and... I honestly, I don't mean the Mel Gibson version. I'd be happy with the Eddie Murphy version, but I would have liked to have seen Eddie Murphy doing something very close to the original script, which I think they shot something along the lines of, and not this version where Paramount went, get back there and do your funnies and make this funny now, doing all that, because I just think it would have been interesting. I love some aspects of this movie, and I love Eddie Murphy's improv. I just think, I'll get onto it in the verdict.
What about you?
I know they were playing on, I guess, the Dalai Lama a little bit, mm-hmm. but if you're casting Little Girl, let the golden child be a little girl.
Thank you! God's sake! They're like, he will do he, and it's like, why?
What's the issue
there? You haven't
there?
Even managed to find a boy that's cute enough. She's a girl, so what's the big deal?
And I'm sorry, they have to save the world.
Oh, right. Yeah, no, I did. I forgot.
And I've actually...
it's not all about being cute. No, I only
say it because I wrote that down and then I crossed it out when I was like, a lot of responsibility.
Well, under this, I did write down, that little girl actually works for the Hollywood Reporter now in events. And she was in Toronto last year and she actually met with Eddie Murphy and the photos are very sweet and I'll post one of them on Twitter. So.
Oh, great. I didn't realise that. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Have I asked you for your change? I can't remember now.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. That's the original version.
I want the original version, yeah. So, I'll show you the script.
This is an arch thing to say, and it's not meant, but just I went into this as a grown-up, having not watched this film for easily 30 years? How old am I? Yeah, maybe 30 years. Mm. And I wanted it to make me laugh as much as I thought it would, because I remember thinking it was brilliant when I was little. And that's not to besmirch it now, because I've got that rose-tinted view of it, but it didn't make me laugh. It just didn't. And unless you think the word ass is funny, which I do, but...
You're breaking my heart.
Yeah, that is funny. It's not funny enough. And you can see where Eddie Murphy just looks like he doesn't give a fuck. He is not even trying. And like what you said, Chris, like they did it once and went, oh, fuck it, that'll do.
Yeah.
And they were right because people went to see it and it made a fortune. But I just felt really let down.
I mean, yeah, I agree. Yeah. Chunky asses is...
It's not that funny.
It's not that funny. Butt pie isn't funny either.
No.
I like pie, but... butt pie. Yeah, great. Well, is that done? That is that done.
That's that done.
All right, then. Ass wipe. Right, we have done The Golden Child. So we did Big Trouble in Little China on Monday. The Golden Child has just been finished. It's time to do the verdict.
You want answers? I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth.
So which movie is going to win this week? Chris, these were your choices. No, they weren't. They were my choices. I almost forgot then. These were my choices. So I will guide us through this section and give you my verdict last. Who would like to go first? Anyone chomping at the bit to get their verdict out there?
No.
I'm going to go with Victoria.
So when you announced these films the other week, I was like, it doesn't even matter what happens. I'm going to pick The Golden Child because I love it so much. And then when I watched Big Trouble in Little China last night, I was like, it's a crying shame. It's a crime that this film didn't do as well as it should have done. I really, really enjoyed it and it really surprised me. And so Big Trouble in Little China is my choice because it's just better. Just is.
There you have it. That's one for Big Trouble in Little China. Christopher?
Yeah, Golden Child.
the trouble is that the tone with the blood porridge and the butt pie, that the tone is not quite right. And the big trouble, the tone is exactly right, I think, but that maybe is why it wasn't a success, because it was people hadn't seen that before. But I also like the way Golden Child follows conventions, whereas Big Trouble defies them at every turn. It does that, which is more entertaining to watch. And I was, you know, thinking about this exploitation that was levelled at these films, I think Golden Child does take that Eastern mysticism a bit without trying to understand it, whereas Carpenter does endeavour to stay true to Chinese cinema with the style of fighting he uses, the wire work, the language of the action, all that kind of stuff. And it dabbles in Fu Manchu stereotype, which is problematic. But I think it did more good than harm, because... as I said on the last episode, those Chinese characters are good and smart and skilled and heroic, and Jack Burton is the idiot American. But it set me on a course, and lots of people I know, to watch Jackie Chan movies and Shaw Brothers movies, and it got all these actors a lot of work in the future, which I don't think they would have leading up to this point, playing heroes in Western movies. So I'm going to use that quote that I said from John Carpenter on the last episode. He said, "Golden Child has a pre-sold ingredient, Eddie Murphy. Big Trouble doesn't, so I had to make a better movie." I think he did.
Wow. Two votes for Big Trouble in Little China. Just for the record, I will now give my vote. I think both of these films are actually flawed. I'm certainly not one of these people that views Big Trouble in Little China as this cult phenomenon that is brilliant. I think another connection that we could have done with these films is two films that are entirely bereft of jeopardy in any way, shape or form. The Golden Child is Eddie Murphy doing that very 80s comedy thing of delivering deadpan underreactions to bizarre, threatening situations. So there's no threat in The Golden Child. There's at no point are you like, oh my God, what's going to happen? Mm. A Big Trouble in Little China, Kurt Russell is so confused as to what's going on the whole time and doing pratfalls. I think that reduces the threat of that movie. And so you end up watching these movies for the comedy, which I think neither of them are as funny as they should be. But overall, I'm basing this week's verdict on the film that I think is overflowing with ideas and genuinely feels like more care and attention and desire to make a good movie as opposed to just a money-making star vehicle. It even manages to overcome Kurt Russell's knee-high moccasins. So Big Trouble in Little China. It's a full house. Woo. Full house. Congratulations to Big Trouble in Little China. Then it's bested The Golden Child on Clash of the Titles, if not at the box office. Oh, what a journey. Time to look ahead. What are we doing next week? Chris, these are your choices. Remind us of the clue you gave us.
Just when I think I'm out, they pull me back in. Not The Godfather.
Right. Drag Me to Hell.
Oh, I love Drag Me to Hell. Should we do that instead?
Oh, can we?
No, we had, because I put all the genres up that we'd covered on Twitter, and we had people actually complaining that we hadn't done gangster movies.
Don't say complaining.
It was a complaint.
Highlighting.
Well, no, it was a complaint. I mean, did you read it? It was like,
no.
it pretty much said, why are you doing these shit films when you haven't done gangster movies? Do gangster movies. It sounds like a complaint.
But it's absolutely right. We should do gangster movies. It's been a year. So we're doing gangster movies. Alex, I'm taking you back to 1980. You're doing The Long Good Friday.
Oh.
And Vicky, you're getting 2004. Layer Cake.
Okay.
Cool. Great. Gangster me up. I haven't watched a gangster movie in ages because I've only watched films for this podcast. Is that something that they say in gangster movies?
Gangster me up.
Yeah. I thought it might be. I was just rolling the dice on that one. All right then. So, The Long Good Friday and The Cake of Layers. Those are next week's movies. Do your homework. We will be back on Monday to talk through The Long Good Friday. Layer Cake will be Thursday. In the meantime, I'm going to ask you a favour. Please rate and review us where you can and subscribe to us where possible on Apple, Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. Congratulations to Big Trouble in Little China. See you on Monday.
This was a Stakhanov production.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember. Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.